friends. Welcome to Spill the Beans, a podcast hosted by me, Kelly Jo, where I have conversations with friends about life, love, faith, and anything else they want to spill the beans about. On this week's episode, you'll hear the conversation I had with two great guys, John and Ben. You may have heard Ben from episode 5, Man of Elements, but this is John's Spill the Beans debut. John is one of my old college professors who turned to be a friend, and Ben met John at camp when he was a speaker, and I met Ben working at camp, and we all became friends with each other. This conversation happened because we all wanted to hang out before John flew back to Missouri this summer. We talk about pop culture, social penetration, theater, and storytelling. I will admit that I didn't quite have a destination in mind when we started talking, but I think the talk was very interesting and thought-provoking, and I hope you enjoy. I have my friends John and Ben here. You want to say hi?
Hi.
That was John. Ben has been a previous guest of Spill the Beans.
Oh, you have?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
It was like, wasn't it like your most popular episode?
It kind of was.
Because that's kind of a big deal. It's my claim to fame.
Yeah. And then John is an old friend, and he used to be my college professor. So tell us, my Spill the Beans listeners, how we met, and what is one of the first memories you have of you and I hanging out?
I used to teach at a place called Multnomah Bible College, which then became Multnomah University, to which Kelly Jo was a student, and I taught communication studies classes, and one of my first memories of Kelly Jo was, were you in my communication studies class?
I think so, with Wendy.
Yeah, were you with Wendy? Because you were in a communication studies major.
No.
I don't know why you took that class.
I had to take an elective, I think.
Well, anyway, she and her friend named Wendy were in my class.
We were roommates too, by the way.
A couple things I remember about them is they were really into a singer called Keisha at the time. And something about the popo and something like that. And
you were into Kesha?
Kesha, yeah. With a dollar sign.
I think that's when her hit, that one hit song came on. And like everybody was singing it. Senior year of college.
Talk about Spill the Beans, you know, there.
Probably.
But anyway, I remember about the popo and something like that. So I used that as an example in class. And you came up and Wendy came up and you were shocked that I included popular culture.
It's true.
In my stuff, and so like I would show YouTube videos, and that was odd for a lot of Multnomah professors.
Side note, Wendy and I bonded over our love for pop culture and The Hills because we were the only Christians on campus that watched like MTV.
So I used pop culture in my classes, which they were like, "Whoa, I like that." And then in my comm theory class, I remember you and her specifically because I would always try to make a comm theory real by attaching it to dating stuff. Because I try to find things that I can connect with students to think about comm theory in real life. And so for a lot of them, it was all about dating. And so like social penetration theory, I related that to dating.
Yep, I remember that.
Or let's say another one.
You might have to unpack that later.
and other comm theory stuff. And I remember there was one day we were in class, and this guy who everybody disliked or who was a real player, I don't know what.
Yeah, he was.
But there's something around Multnomah that you can go on a walk. It's called the Multnomah Walk, right? It's
Multnomah
basically
Mile.
Multnomah Mile. It's guys and girls would walk around it together.
This is like before they were officially dating.
Before it basically was around the whole square of the block of the campus.
If you were walking with the opposite sex, you knew they were like talking it out, maybe like
TTR.
Might like each other.
Well, this one guy was walking with this girl, and I don't know if it was you or Wendy, and you were like, you literally stopped in the middle of class and went, no!
We were yelling at the window saying, run away!
Telling the girl to run away! And I was trying to use it as like a calm theory moment, but you were like, I was like, sort of like this couple, you know, who are, you know, maybe they're going through social penetration right now, and then you were like, no, not run away!
I need to know what social penetration theory is.
This is a great time to talk about it, because this is one of the classic icebreakers I use.
You
all
do?
The time. Well, I used it
at camp that one time when I was program director.
How do you use that as an icebreaker?
Because, you know, when people, like, are kind of weird and they're not sure if, you know, how they feel about each other. Like, hey.
Oh.
This is social penetration. And then they get really weird when you use the word penetration.
Wait, but what is it?
Yeah. See, and that's where I start off with. I say penetration does not equal sex, all right? And that's... I talk about it right away. I go, let's all giggle it out here. Penetration does not equal sex.
Say the word penetration.
I say, just say the word penetration. And I, and in that, you use the word penetration over and over again. And everybody's like, oh, you just used the word penetration. But, you know, do you remember that? Do you remember Shrek? Where Shrek is walking along with Donkey and he goes, people are like onions. Remember that episode or that scene from it? And he said, you know, some people, you just know the top layer. Other people, you peel back the onion, you know, all the way into the inner core. And so social penetration theory by Altman and Taylor, if you care to look it up, they believe that you have layers of different, like some people you let it on the surface level. Other people, you let all the way into the middle, the core, your deepest, darkest thoughts. And then on top of that, so slice the onion in half, and then you turn the onion into pies. And so you have a pie about relationship. A pie about your future, a pie about your beliefs on religion or sports, or and so on. Depending on the relationship, you let certain people all the way. Like you might have a buddy that you talk about, say you're like just fun pop culture things or theater, and you let him penetrate you all the way into the core, and that's what that's where people. Others, you only let him penetrate a little bit because this is like. Like your religious beliefs, you might only let some people penetrate you a little bit. Others, you might let them penetrate you all the way to the core on your political beliefs or your religious beliefs, stuff that's a little more intimate maybe, or a little you're afraid to reveal yourself. It ties into self-disclosure.
Oh.
So the more you disclose of yourself... So, I say in a relationship, so I have him draw it out. What should your intimate relationship look like? Mm-hmm. And I said, and I say, you should allow that person to penetrate you repeatedly on different pies.
How can you do
that? And people are like, ugh. But the problem is that, let's say you're in an intimate relationship, right, with a guy. And when I mean intimate, I'm not talking sexual, just, you know him really well.
Yeah.
You've allowed him to penetrate you in various of your pies. Mm-hmm. And the more you penetrate a person, the harder it gets because it gets tighter and the core gets smaller and it's really hard to penetrate into that core of the onion. But again, the guy in our book, the guy even admits it has sexual overtones all over it, but it has nothing to do with it. And some people think they should explore that more. But... The problem is you have penetration. So you let's say you've allowed a guy to penetrate you on various pies.
Yeah, socially.
Then you break up. Then you have depenetration. So now you've got these open holes that you've allowed somebody in. Now you've broken up. What do? You feel betrayed. You feel... Right. But if you do happen to get back together again, the penetration is fast at that point because you've already been down this hole and, you know...
Yeah.
And so you can, the main thing is you can measure how close you are to a person. And it really isn't sexual because social penetration can be, you know, between two genders of the same gender or anybody. It's just friendship. But we talked a lot about in class with dating.
Because everybody's
dating. And so, and that's where she was like, no. I was like, these two people are penetrating each other as they're walking along. But a lot of it is, and then I would say self-disclosure. If you want any relationship to take off, studies show them, self-disclosure is the fuel for the rocket of love, is what I used to say. So the more you open up, as a guy especially, the better the chance that the... relationship will take off. And the problem is most women will allow themselves to be penetrated, but a lot of men
not so much.
Don't. They it's harder for them to self-disclose for whatever reason. And like some people, you know really well about their, like I have a friend who I would say we talk a lot about like history or politics or stuff that doesn't matter to him, but I don't know if he's happy with his job or happy in his marriage or
his faith or anything like
But if you want a close relationship, that's where, and so many of us in the church or in our, we have a lot of what I would call shallow relationships because we don't want to be penetrated. Mm-hmm. And
that's really interesting. So that's how we became friends.
Through that. and then she asked me to MC the junior-senior. And then she's a good friend named Wendy, and she is also into pop culture. Mm-hmm. She's a big fan of, who's the guy from...
The Kardashians?
No, the guy I thought was from Oakland is actually from Chicago.
R. Kelly,
yeah. Wendy, will she be listening to this?
Yeah,
she probably will. Yeah, Wendy Thornell is a huge fan of R. Kelly.
She's going to hate you for saying that.
She's what?
I said she's going to hate you for saying that. We also, at the end of our scene...
Because I thought R. Kelly was from Oakland, where she's from.
Where Wendy's from, yeah.
And no, he's from Chicago, but...
And wasn't our senior year of college your last year at Multnomah?
Yeah.
So we made you a mug that had our picture on it.
Yeah.
And our name on it. And do you still have that mug?
I do.
Do you drink out of it?
I don't, because it's all the way to the back. But I might bring to pull it out and put it on my desk.
Remember your two favorite students?
Right, and I will admit, I do think it was we had fun at Multnomah. A lot of people are very serious there.
They are.
And the other thing I would say is our love of pop culture.
Yeah.
And communications together, I think, brought us.
We would sit at lunch, us three, and just talk about like pop culture, what was going on. We talk about movies. I think that's when we started making fun of my love for Hallmark movies, probably.
Hallmark movies.
And you and Wendy bonded over The Lost, the TV show, and how much you
Not The Lost, it's just called
Lost.
Have you seen Lost?
Like, a few episodes here and there, so I know that, like, it's trippy, but I don't know the story of it.
That's my history, too.
So do you think you have socially penetrated with anybody to a deep level?
Probably. Yeah, probably.
Do you have some good friends?
Yeah.
Do you have friends?
I mean, I have one or two friends. Yeah.
But I mean good friends.
Yeah, no.
You probably penetrated each other.
The first person that comes to mind is my friend Roman, who he and I, like, have known each other for a long time and kind of know everything about each other.
Yeah.
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 Then you're socially penetrated.
Yeah, I think we're very full of penetration.
That's interesting.
Right. But it's funny, it's the worst name in the world, and whoever came up with it.
Or it's like the best name in the world because it brings like a weight to it of like this is serious business.
True.
And I do think the idea act of penetrating is painful and like, do I want to allow this? And there is something invasive about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
But I do want to say our love of pop culture, I am not a fan of Kardashians. Mm-hmm. I used to make fun of you guys for all that.
I only watched it because it was in the background. But
Wendy loved the Kardashians.
She still watches it.
Is it still going?
Yeah, it is. And then John and Ben, how did you guys become friends?
No, I didn't. So. But John still does speak at the camp that I worked at for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. You worked there for 10 years?
Yeah, and I used to be the program director and like run all the programs, and now I'm on the board there. But John would come and speak, and all the other speakers at camp, they did the camp speaker thing, which was like, here's my PowerPoint, here's my three like main bullet points, and my trendy, cool videos and like cool skater music that's gonna really hook you in, and like everything's gonna alliterate and all this kind of stuff, which is fine and good, and I think helpful for a lot of people who think that way. But when John would come, he would just stand up there with a microphone and tell a story. And the first time I heard John speak, I was like, this is very different. And also, like, I was like, oh, wait, chapel's already over? Because it's so... Here's the thing. I'm sure you are aware of this as a communications professor. But that story is, like, hijack our brains a little bit. And, like, you lose track of everything else because our brains are made to engage in stories. Which I am all about as an actor. But...
that's interesting. I have no clue what the others do. I don't know what other speakers do. So I am that different from a lot of them.
Yeah, and I think it's wonderful. And I remember after the first time hearing you speak, the first session, I went to Joe and I was like, this guy needs to come back and do all of them. We need this guy. Because it's just, I don't know, like...
Resident storytelling.
I mean, to be honest, like, when you look at what's actually in the Bible, like, 10% of it is instructional. but 99% of how we teach it is instructional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But like 80% of it is narrative.
Yeah.
And we are so bad in 21st century America at letting faith be narrative, mm-hmm. and letting it be a story, and letting it be a story that unfolds naturally with the good and the bad, and, mm-hmm. and letting that tell us something about who God is. And when we just tell the stories well, mm-hmm. That's so powerful.
I think it is too.
Well, and that's neat to hear, because again, I have no clue what others do, and I learned this from another guy who he calls it expository, in the sense that he goes through the passage, mm-hmm. but a narrative, he doesn't, you know, make it, but he pulls in all the stuff that's there but not there. And so I bring in I try to fill it in, but I do try to keep it in a narrative, because I'm with you that I heard this guy speak and I was like, wow, you could listen to him all day, and it didn't feel like, but I felt like, man, I think I could do that, because I do like to tell stories, you know, and I love that. Whenever I've done it, I get a lot of great responses from people. And what shocks me is when people tell me, I've never heard it that way before. And that's where I feel like, well, we read it that way. Yeah. I wonder why we don't just speak it that way.
It's because we're always looking for, like, the moral of the story, or, like, the...
Yeah.
The point or whatever.
Yeah.
Instead of letting that come naturally just from...
And there's been times where I feel like I really did force that story to make a point. And my wife has been a big one on, because it's her dad who sort of turned me on to this type of speaking. And she always tells me, just tell the story. That's the thing she drums mm-hmm. in my head. Just tell the story. Don't get caught up in trying to really make this point that should be obvious coming from this story. Because it's probably more obvious than you think. Just tell the story and let the story work its magic, you know?
Yeah, I like that. This is a good place to head. So, you guys are both storytellers, but in very different arenas, right? Mm-hmm. So, Ben, you're an actor or a theater... Is that... You're called an actor, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought so.
I'm not like an actress.
Right. I didn't know if theater had a different word for it.
A thespian? No. Nope.
All right.
We're actors.
Actors. And then, John, you're a professor. And so,
but also, like, an actor.
Yeah, that's true, because you got into acting, and you were, like, a leader of a theater group.
Yeah, I'm more of a director, I would say. But I have been in...
But you tell stories in life.
Right. And I get my acting buzz, if you want to call it that, or my joy out of this mm-hmm. narrative style of speaking, which does require you to... act to a certain extent.
Which is what your podcast is going to be, right? For those who don't know, John is going to come out with
yes,
a storytelling podcast
where
he just tells stories.
Well, if you could help me come up with a title for my podcast, that's my thing. Spill the beans. It's so brilliant.
And then we just
I don't know what to call this thing, so we'll have to come up with that later.
Yeah. Alrighty.
But I hope that, I hope to start one, maybe.
Yeah, I think you should do that. But as storytellers, what do you think is like an important part of telling a story? What is the thing that you, like, gets you excited about telling a story, or, you know, why do you like it? Why do you do it? I'll let you think about it, because for me, this podcast is a storytelling in sorts, because I collect people or friends and have them come on and tell a snippet of their story, of their life, of whatever they're thinking about, and have them spill the beans about it. So I'm having you come on and tell a piece of your story, a piece of your life. But what is that? Like, why? Because when I ask people to share things, they're taken aback, but then they get really excited because I think that they want to be heard from and they want to be...
they want to tell their story.
Feel important, and they want to tell their story. So you guys both tell stories. I mean, in some of it is your own and some of it's a play or something that someone gives you. Or you tell a story of Bible.
I think both of us tell other people's stories, right?
Yeah.
And he tells stories more in a... He takes on a role, mm-hmm. so he...
So what do you guys like? What do you like about that, Ben?
Well, I think, like what you just said, that everyone's got, like, this story that, and you're asking them to share it. And I think we live in story. We, like, you know what I mean? That's how life unfolds. It's not a series of randomly unconnected events. It's like we see a natural progression to our stories. And, like, there are unexpected things, and there are things that make perfect sense. And mm-hmm. and so I think we connect and somehow find ourselves in somebody else's story, or in, like, the stories in the Bible or in, like, hearing somebody else's story. And my job as a storyteller is to help people see themselves in what I'm doing on stage. There's this great quote that I love, which is, acting is standing on stage naked and turning around slowly. which is obviously a metaphor.
Yeah.
But it's, like, all about just standing on stage and being honest about the human condition, about where we find ourselves, about, how we approach things like love and relationship and God and faith. And so I think that there's value in hearing somebody else's story, because we ourselves are living a story and can find ourselves perhaps more clearly mm-hmm. when we're engaging in somebody else's narrative. Mm. Also, I think story is about taking what might seem, at least maybe I should say art. Yeah, this might be true. Is taking elements of a story that might seem disconnected, or elements of life that might seem disconnected, and putting meaning to them, mm-hmm. right? And sometimes that meaning is pretty false. Sometimes that meaning is like really unhelpful or pretty obviously flawed in some way, right? Mm-hmm. But sometimes we can, as we place what seems random into a meaningful arc, mm-hmm. we go, oh, something's happening here. You know what I mean? Like, if you read one little part of the Old Testament of the Bible, you're like, what is wrong with these people? What is wrong with this God? What is going on? Like, it seems so random and bizarre. Mm-hmm. But when you read, like, the whole arc and the whole story and you see it all in context, you go, oh, something is happening. Mm-hmm. I think that's a huge part of storytelling is creating meaning or a through line to something that might otherwise seem disconnected. And when people see that, they go, maybe there is meaning to my story also. Mm. And what seems disconnected and random.
I like that. John, what do you think? Why do you like telling stories?
I have two basic things.
Okay.
One spiritual and one just because I enjoy it.
Okay.
Spiritual one is, I remember a professor in college saying, it is a sin to make the Bible boring, and especially to kids. And so I really cherish the fact that I don't want kids to think the Bible is just full of three main points and a poem and then you're done. And people can take, there are exciting stories in the Bible that people just suck the life out of, you know? And I just don't want to do that. And so I'm driven to make the Bible exciting, and by telling stories, kids have lots of questions. So not at this camp, mm-hmm. but at another camp I was at, where I told the story of creation that I did this week and all that. Mm-hmm. I had a whole cabin of girls. They wanted to meet with me afterwards with their counselor, like on day three, and they had a whole ton of questions based on, you know, my brother is struggling in his faith. What is his future like? Or they had questions that I hadn't even thought of off of the story that were in these fifth graders, sixth graders' minds that the counselor was like, I don't have a good answer for. So to me, the fact that they were asking questions off the story made me realize, hey, they're enjoying the story. They want to know more, and hopefully that'll get them excited about studying the Bible. And mm-hmm. so one of my big goals is I don't want to make the Bible boring, and I think telling the story, man, that gets kids thinking. They're excited. There's something about the narrative process that makes you think more than people think,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing is just purely, I really enjoy being up there with a mic and the challenge of telling a story so good that people suck into listening to you. And you don't need PowerPoint, you don't need lights, you don't need anything. There's something challenging to me that says, hey, I want to find a way to tell this story in such a way that's true to the text, but it's so good that I've got these 315 kids in the palm of my hands for 30, 40 minutes. And I love that challenge.
Yeah. You sound like an actor.
Like,
like there's this whole philosophy in theater. I think it's a Peter Brook's famous director philosophy of don't put anything on stage that you don't need to tell the story. So, like, the idea of just simplifying everything and just letting it be about the story. Mm-hmm. And that's so engaging. And we think that it's about the spectacle, especially in, like, churches and camps. We think it's about the spectacle, but it's really not.
And I don't have a scientific study on this, but the last two times I've tried to incorporate PowerPoint more into my stories, it's failed, I think. Because now, instead of using their brain to connect with me and who they envision these people are like, I'm showing up a picture. And I think it messed up the narrative, the flow, and it messed up their pulling into the story with me.
Mm-hmm. I also am aware of this. When you do, like, you said something about engaging people's brains in a different way. When you give a lecture, which I think most of what camp speaker or what a lot of camp speakers or church speakers do is give a lecture, right? Mm-hmm. Here's the ideology or the idea here. Mm-hmm. Then what you're telling people is here's a like set of precepts to conform to or to adopt, mm-hmm. to sign your name on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're setting up a thing for them to become, and they either, so that what they're doing is evaluating themselves, going, do I believe that, or do I meet that, or do I, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But in the story, especially the stories of the Bible, like, nothing human is foreign or unwelcome. And so, like, people, I think, are free to ask the questions they have naturally, because they're not self-evaluating and go, do I match what this person is saying? But they are instead being sucked into the story, and it's grabbing the human part of them that is like that has all these questions and that has all these interests and curiosities. And
so I'm wondering, because you said, well, what I surmise is technology takes away from.
Well, it's like when everybody says, I always preferred the book over the movie.
Yeah.
Because now you see what Harry Potter looks like. Well, in your brain, Harry Potter looked in totally way different. Cooler, and now they always hate the movie because it ruins imagination, and imagination is a integral part of focus for an audience in a story.
So then my question, ultimate question, who knows if we have an answer, is does technology make us less human?
Yeah, so we shouldn't do this podcast. Right, there's a microphone and a computer.
This is technology.
Does technology make us less human?
I mean, it maybe it gets in the way of our humanness, of, like, fully experiencing it.
Well, like I was saying earlier, Moses and his people, they sat around the fire telling stories. Mm-hmm. And that was their entertainment, you know? We're still really into stories. I mean, I was looking at Netflix. I mean, just think, I mean, students at college will tell me they'll binge watch hours of, I mean, people love stories. I think we're just more visual now, and the technology allows us mm-hmm. to pull into that visual. Mm-hmm. I think the only way technology hurts us would be, do people have the concentration capacity to watch something like live theater? And, like, I don't know if technology hurts theater. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I wonder if technology might hurt like listening to me tell a story. If I can get you, if I can hook you into the story, I think I can. That's part of the challenge. I can pull a kid who's Snapchatting. If I can pull you into my story,
so they put that away.
Yeah, and I think sometimes theater might, people are like, well, it's not a movie. I want special effects, or I want this or that.
Yeah.
But if you meet a great play and are pulled into that theatrical moment, you know. But I do think it can hurt you, because some people are like, well, I don't want to just sit there and watch a play, or I don't want to just sit there and listen to somebody talk. I need more. But what they don't realize is they could get pulled in if they would just let themselves.
And there's something different that happens when there's a live person in front of you, mm-hmm. as opposed to a screen in front of you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We forget that. I think people, in my worldview, right? People bear the image of God, right?
Right.
And in my worldview, like, there's a spiritual element to every human.
Right.
And that spirit and that image of God communicates with each other when those two people are face to face, right? Sometimes positively, sometimes negatively. But when there's a screen, what you're doing is you're watching bits and pixels pretending to be human. But they don't have spirit. They don't have image of God. And so when you're speaking live to somebody and telling them a live story like you do, or when you're on stage live, there is a what some people in the theater world that I know call a communion that happens between the audience and the person telling the story.
Cool.
It's interesting that you mentioned Peter Brooks, because I read one of his books when I was younger. And,
really?
And I tried it. I ran a drama team, and we would go to churches, and I didn't want to bring a big stage, because they're electrical. We would blow out their panels or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I developed in my head, I called it Theater of the Found Space. That's what I called it. So whatever space we found, that was going to be our theater, and we adapted it accordingly. And so we had a lot of what I would call more oral interpret, more storytelling, but theater mixed in. And, mm-hmm. and it was pretty successful. And I called it Theater of the Found Space, and I think I might have borrowed that from Peter Brooks in the sense, if he has this theory that the less you have up there.
Yeah, he does. I think it's in his book called The Empty Space.
And that's probably where I got, I think I read that book. It's interesting.
Cool. It's really cool.
Because it is true. I mean, I think the less technology sometimes the... And there's a part of me, too, that fundamentally, like, I love to watch a good stand-up comic. And the fact that he can tell a story and pull people in, that to me, I don't want to turn preaching or speaking into stand-up comic. But there is something about a stand-up comic that he can tell a story that is so funny. You know, hundreds of people listen to Jim Gaffigan tell about going to McDonald's or his experience with Hot Pockets. And you're like, how does he do that? Well, it's a story, but I am so impressed with stand-up comics that they can do that for an hour, you know?
When you watch a comedy special and it gets interrupted by, like, a behind-the-scenes bit or by, like, a... Like some of the intro bits are really long and it's all these different scenes or if like in the middle of it gets interrupted with another like bit, you're like, no, go away. I want to see, I just want to see this person. And so I think sometimes, you know, we use technology to enhance our storytelling sometimes, but sometimes we just put it in there because it's cool and flashy and catches our attention, like fires off more synapses in our brain rather than the fact that it actually tells the story better. You know what I mean?
Now, the difference I have is interesting between a stand-up comic and an actor. There's lots of differences. But one of the differences is you guys like to take on roles.
Yeah.
While a Jim... I'm picking on Jim Gaffigan. I don't know. Whoever. Some comedian. He is happy being in his own skin or being playing himself, telling you a story. And so I don't know if that relates in the sense that... Would you be happy just being Ben in front of people? Or do you feel like you have to play a role to... Like, I've heard Dustin Hoffman is incredibly shy... And he only comes alive when he takes on another character, you know?
That's a deep question. But I will say that I think the place you start with any character is empathy, right? How do I relate to this person and what their experience is? And the role of the actor, I think, is not to project emotion, but to actually feel real feelings on stage in front of, you know, a few hundred people. So that to me, is an incredibly personal and vulnerable act. I mean, the stand-up comic can tell stories from their own life, but they don't necessarily have to relive those emotions and those, you know what I mean? Right. The actor's job is to be living that experience as they do it, which I think is incredibly vulnerable. But I will also say something we talked about in college a lot was that there's actually no more loving or Christ-like act than taking on another person's reality or like stepping into another person's world, which is incarnation, right? Which is, I'm going to step into your world. And so there's, when you think about it in those terms, there can be something extremely vulnerable and just spiritual about that practice. But I also know a lot of actors, and I'm always tempted to do this myself, where you just want to like, you just want to put it on, you want to project the emotion and you want to just like pretend you're in the situation rather than being in the situation. Does that make sense?
And then
I also know a lot of actors, and again, something I have to be aware of in myself, who when they go to a party or they go to a social function, they're putting on the character that is expected of them in that space.
Right.
Instead
of just being like...
Right, because it's easy to...
Well, have you read any of Irving Goffman's stuff?
Uh-uh.
He believes that we're all actors and we have a script that we run in any given situation. And when we enter it, we enter, let's say I put on Party John and I run Party John's script. When I exit, I don't know what I become. When I come to class, I put on Academic John and run that script. problem is when we run scripts that don't match the scene that we're in, and he has all this stuff.
Huh. What, who is that?
It's Irving Goffman, G-O-F-F-M-A-N. You know, it's he takes that metaphor that all the world's a stage, and he says we're all merely actors, and he literally came up with a whole theory based on that
stuff.
Interesting. That's really interesting.
But my question is, okay, let's say you feel, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would say, I think, isn't that why some actors essentially go nuts? Because, okay, every night you're feeling.
Yeah,
every night
yeah.
I mean, isn't there a point where you emotionally can't, like this doesn't relate, but I was in this little theater production of this really, of a show once, and I had to become hysterical on stage every night for like a 2-week run. And it was emotionally exhausting mm-hmm. for me, and I realized then, I was like, I don't know if I could do this for a living. And that's where I wonder if you do have to put up a front, because you can't, you know, if you're playing Macbeth or that deep emotion every single night.
Yeah. I think that's true, and I think unfortunately a lot of actors, the people in the acting world are often known for their carousing, or they're just like party making or whatever, you know, they're and like they're kind of carefree wild lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And it's because a lot of actors don't have good self-care mechanisms, and so what they're doing is trying to recover from the emotional strain of their work. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing that for 8 hours a day at a theater that's hiring you full time, you know, it can be exhausting. And I think it's so essential, I think, for first and foremost, to have something or someone or a group of people who are pulling you back into reality. Who like you are being rooted in that reality. Someone to give you a hug when you get home, somebody that you call after rehearsal, whatever it is, you know? And so I think that's important. But I also think just having good, so getting pulled back into reality and being reminded of what is real and what's mm-hmm. what was on stage and what's real. And then also taking care of yourself emotionally, understanding that what just happened took a toll on me mm-hmm. and I need to do what I need to do. And it takes a lot of discipline. I need to do what I need to do to recharge that rather than just ignore it by going out drinking or whatever it is, you know? Mm-hmm. And then sometimes, for me, sometimes self-care. I was just in a show in the fall that was very emotionally taxing. It was a beautiful and heartbreaking story. And I had to, I was the main guy, and I had to, you know, fall in love with two different people. One of them died. The other one, their relationship fell apart because of unfaithfulness. Mm-hmm. The second to last scene, I sobbed and... Like,
you did that for how many nights a week?
We did that for 35 performances. And
she had a sob every night.
Yeah.
For 35.
And so like that, sometimes when I was in that space, I knew I have had a really hard day. Right now, situations in my life are emotionally taxing. Mm-hmm. And I knew tonight I'm not going to be able to let myself go all the way. I'm going to still hit my mark. I'm still going to give what I need to give. Mm-hmm. But part of my self-care means that tonight, like... I'm gonna go as far as my body wants to go, but I'm not gonna force it to go any further. You know, I'm not gonna be like, no, we're really gonna feel this right now. You know what I mean? I'm not gonna trick my emotions tonight. I'm just gonna let it.
Now take the scene where you had to sob.
Yeah.
Did you get fearful about having to do that scene sometimes every single night, or were you able to? It's just part of the story, the acting, and it just naturally led to it, and you were okay with it, or...
Yeah, normally I was okay with it, because, I think when you're in the context of it, right?
Of the play.
And then when the play ends, you have to sort of leave it on stage, like intentionally leave it on stage.
Well, and that's where you hear about all these actors who have messed up relationships, because I don't think they can leave it on stage.
Yeah. I think you have to be able to, or like actors who fall in love with the person they're playing opposite, and like, that's a bad idea. Like wait until the show closes, at least.
Now are you a method actor, or do you buy into a specific?
Because
it seems like the method actors are the ones that can't leave it on stage.
It depends on what you mean. So like, if you're actually talking The Method by Stanislavski,
yeah,
he's talking about all the sense memory stuff, which is like you're trying to basically live the life of your character.
Yeah,
I think that's unhelpful for me. I find that I give the best performance on stage if my life is rooted in reality, and if I am like. If I'm really taking care of my real life and I'm being a rooted human being, then my performance on stage is going to be better rather than if I'm trying to make my life match my character's life and never stepping
out of character. So what method do you sort of buy into, is there a method you buy into?
I think there's a book called The Actor and the Target that has always shaped the way I act. But I think for me it's all about attention and receiving from your castmates. So, like, what I'm getting from someone on stage is more important than how I'm going to say my next line. Because if I'm just listening well and really receiving what they're giving me, my next line is naturally going to come out how it needs to come out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's actually really freeing because it's a practice in forgetting yourself, which actors like me tend to be very self-conscious and thinking about themselves all the time in every situation. Mm-hmm. And so it's a good practice of, like, forgetting about yourself and just focusing on the other. Mm. I think that's the thing that I found most helpful.
So when you prepare for a role, you use the word through line. You don't work out your, what's that called again? You know, you work out the character's, it's a method thing. What is it? Where you work out where your next moment is.
Oh, the beats and all that stuff?
Yeah.
Sometimes I do if I'm really struggling with what a scene, like the structure of a scene and where it shifts between this or that. But normally I find sort of the arc of the character throughout rehearsal. You know, it's just.
Yeah, the motivation. That's what I was looking for.
Oh, sure.
Because some of those, they want you to break them down into little motivational moments.
Oh, yeah.
And I found it better to help with that, like, bigger motivational arcs, like you were saying.
I've done that with small scenes, and sometimes, or with, like, my minuscule scene work. And sometimes I still will if I'm in a moment where I'm like, I am playing one note through this whole scene. Hmm. That's because I don't understand what I want. So I better go through and figure out what I want in this moment and this moment and this moment. So sometimes I will.
But overall, you're more looking for the bigger motivational moments, like you said, in the arc of the character.
Yeah, I want to live in the truth of all of those, you know, the bigger story, rather than having a technically minute, correct performance that really doesn't have anything beyond that.
See, in theater, I'm talking old school since I haven't done it for a while, but you want to find out what you need to motivate, you need to motivate your movements on stage, you know what I mean? You shouldn't just walk over to the left because the director told you to. You should motivate it from the character, correct?
Yeah.
So I would say, story-wise, back to your question, I think that might would be an interesting discussion. What motivates a character in a story has a lot of spiritual application. Like, what motivates us in life? You know, I think that's interesting.
Well, what motivates you in life?
Ooh,
that's too big a question for me. But
well, what I was also thinking of is this. You guys come. You look at the storytelling in a really interesting, unique way. Has that made you a better person, a better human, to look at life in a different, more unique way? And, I don't know, tell your story. Yes, Ben, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, well, I think both happen simultaneously, you know what I mean? You become a better storyteller the better you get at living life well. Mm. And I think the better storyteller you become, the more information you have about how to live life well and what the pitfalls might be and what it means to show up and be present. You know what I mean? Those mm-hmm. kinds of things. So I think they sort of both happen simultaneously for me.
What about for you, John?
I don't know. My life's had some ups and downs, and I've loved stories throughout, and a lot of great stories about absolute failure. Yeah. So I would say sometimes being interested in story helps me realize to take a step back and go, just observe it and realize it's not the end of the world. This is part of a bigger story. Don't panic. It's just a chapter. Let's see what the other chapter looks like.
Yeah, yeah.
Or I think something like that. Or sometimes I think, what was the question again? I can't remember.
Does being a storyteller help you become, I don't know.
I think sometimes it helps you look at context better.
In your life.
And you can see how context might function here, and you can sort of sometimes see, at least for me, what how I as a character am impacting others around me and what I should do to change. I'm amazed at how many people have no clue about what they do and how it impacts others. I don't know if being in story and theater helps you understand a little bit
empathy.
Better.
I think we know that, like, scientifically, that stories help us learn empathy.
Mm-hmm. Walk in another man's shoes. That's really interesting. I was also thinking about, you know, we started this conversation about social penetration and, like, how allowing people to see you and get in deeper in different avenues. And I think telling stories creates a bond with another person to grow an affection towards that other person.
Well, you're a counselor, right? Or you've done... in the counseling field, do you do you encourage your counselees to tell a story?
Mm-hmm, for sure.
So are you a good storyteller, or are you more a good story listener? You just like listening to stories.
I mean, I grew up, we grew up in the country where we just kind of hang out with our neighbors or hang out with people. And like, I grew up having neighbors over for fires, and we'd all tell stories at the end of the night. And I think that's where my love for like storytelling or like listening to stories, because I think I'm an okay storyteller when I have something exciting to share, but I don't think I'm very good with creating what, like what you do when you read a story and you're like, okay, that's nice, but you make it come alive. I'm not good at that.
Yeah, and people ask me how, and I just think, well, you just do it, and that's where I'm beginning to realize it's more of a talent than I realize. I just think everybody has this ability, and I'm like, well, for me, it's like at the beginning, I'm like, how can I hook these? I want something to hook them in.
Yeah, you're like methodical.
You can't just begin with a, you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. You know, you can't do that unless you're Star Wars.
Or
so you've got to come up, and so some of that's back to the whole, you know, what was stand-up comedy? What pulls people into those stories? And a lot of it's very big. I don't know how to describe it, but I don't know. And I
my wife will tell you I tell a lot of stories in life. And
yeah, I think that's what's interesting. And I think telling stories there's a bit of vulnerability in it, of like releasing that and showing everybody like, oh, this is a story of when I peed my pants in third grade. Now you know something way more detailed about myself. Or like those things you always have in your back pocket of like, okay, something's, if the party's kind of needing a pick-me-up, this is what I'll do, or this is a story I'll tell. So I think that's
Have you heard a person tell a really bad story? And you're like, oh.
Oh, yeah.
That was so boring.
Oh, yeah. All the time.
I have a friend who cannot tell a story, and she'll be like, well, let me tell you the story, and it's basically she bought something at Target, and you're like, okay, the story went nowhere. It had no end, and I pick on her all the time because her stories go nowhere, you know. And I think that might be part of storytelling, is your story has to have a payoff at the end. Either I'm gonna laugh, or I'm gonna cry, or I'm gonna feel something. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. That's true.
That makes sense. That's funny. And so to, I guess, wrap it up, we've been talking for 46 minutes,
yeah,
which is awesome.
Wow.
To wrap up kind of what we were talking about.
Hang on, though. I do want to say, I am interested in how do you prepare for a role. I'd like to know that.
Do you want me to say that on this podcast?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. I don't want to talk very long, because I have to go soon.
Like, do you just live in the moment and just, like is it in rehearsal?
No. I think a lot of it's in rehearsal, because a lot of it's about what I'm getting from somebody else, right? But I do a lot of, like, reading the script and looking for clues as to who this character is, and like, maybe if it's a real person, doing research.
Now, how much does the director's vision of that character impact you? A lot.
So, oftentimes, the director and the actor are trying to find... A good director and a good actor are trying to find what this character is together. And as they try different things... And sometimes you find the character through physicality. Like, you realize, oh, that this person moves differently than I do. And that brings up some sort of personality trait. And sometimes you find it the opposite, you know, just through some sort of character trait that informs everything else. And so a lot of it's the actor and the director trying things and trying to find what works.
But a lot of it is in rehearsal.
Yeah, a lot of it's in rehearsal. But yeah. I do work outside of it. You know, I sit down with my script and do the work to try to figure out what this character is and who this character is.
So that's my question. What's the work when you sit down
with your script? So some of it's what you were talking about, objectives in different scenes. What does this character want overall? I do a lot of work while I'm driving in my car. I'm just speaking lines out loud as I'm memorizing, but I'm also like, and people think I'm crazy because they drive past and I'm like, why is that guy talking to himself? Why is that guy yelling at himself? Why is he crying?
Why is he sobbing?
Speak these lines out loud and see like how they're connecting to me emotionally, and then what that's telling me about the character, and that's that sort of work. And then sometimes the work looks like just doing straight up research. Like I'm in this project right now called Astoria. It's a two part play. We did part one last year. We're doing part two this year, and it's all history. It's all real history. And I'm playing a real person who actually lived. And so I did a lot of reading on who this guy was and his, like, even his family line and all this kind of stuff. So.
And that helps you put, like, the character on?
Yeah, speak, I think so. And I think when I'm feeling comfortable to show up in a rehearsal room just as Ben, as a person, I am able to find really cool things about my character. Because the truth is, human beings are not all that different from one another. And so sometimes the work looks like going on a little walk before rehearsal to just, like, make sure that I'm in a centered, rooted place, and I feel comfortable showing up in the rehearsal room. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sometimes that's the work, too, I think.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Well, there's somebody like take somebody like Tom Cruise, all right?
Mm-hmm.
He plays the same character pretty much in all his movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you have somebody like Dustin Hoffman who'll take on a complete role.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is the difference between, like, a lead actor and what I would call a character actor, you know? Mm-hmm. But probably in theater, that's different, right?
I think so. And I think a good actor is always specific. Like, it's always about specifics. You can't just play general emotions, right? I think a good actor is always specific. I think a good actor is always present, and it's all about listening and responding. There's that kitsch phrase from theater, there is no acting, there is just reacting.
Yeah.
You know, I think a good actor is always doing that. Whether they're comedy or drama, or whether they're lead, or whether they're sort of in the background, whatever, they're always doing that.
Hmm.
And I think it's always about... here's the truth. We as human beings know how to have a conversation. And all the acting is somebody has given you the words to say in your conversation, and you have to mean them.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And so I think as human beings, there's a lot of times when I'm directing, when someone's like, so should I go, like they're like, I'm like, so you're going to cross up there, and they'll do like this weird like stage turn out. And
yeah,
walk.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, just walk like a person.
Yeah, yeah.
Or like they'll start saying a line. I'm like, just say it, try saying it like a person. Like,
yeah.
Like you know how to do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I think as humans, we know what to do. It's just we get on stage and it all goes out the window and we're like, I don't know what to do with my hands.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I'll say is I once tried out for a Master of Fine Arts in acting and I got accepted. Mm-hmm. But the guy told me, he goes, you're not really a lead actor, you're more of a character actor. And I go, what do you mean by that? And he goes, well, you're not good looking enough to be a lead actor. And I was like, oh.
Oh man, the look matters. The look matters.
It does. I mean, that's what I'm saying. The lead actor.
Interesting.
They tend to be the handsomer, or whatever you want to call it. They have a look that fits that role.
The directors, a lot of directors are have in their mind what the look of this character is.
If you don't meet
the look, then even you could be the best actor in the world, and they won't hire you.
And I have a friend named Kirk who is a handsome man. He got a ton of lead acting roles because
he had a look,
but for that time. But he was also a good looking guy, and I'll admit I'm not super handsome, but my wife finds me handsome enough. But I actually enjoyed the character roles. I don't mind playing an old man or, you know, there's a little more stuff there. But that's where I think, you know, you were talking about a lead actor. I don't know if that distinction's around anymore. But this guy was very much like, yeah, you're good, but you can never be a lead actor. And I was like, thanks for being brutal, but you're probably right. Because, you know, there's height and look and all the stuff. And,
yeah.
And like you said, you know, you wonder... What did you say earlier about if you just, you know, like the roles you're getting, is it just because you've hit a certain time where they like that the look you have plus your talent and all that? And, you know, I don't know. I just find that very interesting.
It's a fickle business, but I love the art form and I love the craft of it.
Yeah.
Do you also see it as, I think sometimes the ones who are more successful in acting, I don't think, how can I put it? They're careful to see it as play. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because if you get too caught up in this is art, you get off your
rocker.
So many
times I have this conversation with people. The people who are artists are the worst to work with.
And
they usually end up not being that great. Because truly, like, I play dress up for a living. That's all I do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's a silly job. It's just a silly job.
But you get paid to play.
I get paid to play. It's all just make-believe. That's what we're doing. It's like kids in their backyard playing make-believe are the best actors, you know?
And I agree, and that's, I think, where the best stories come from, is just you realize this is a fun story, and I'm not going to get too much up in who I am. And I think that play attitude will help you as an actor.
Oh, man, that was going to be our episode, Kelly Jo, the theology of play.
We can still have that.
So
my last question.
Do you think Kelly Jo can act? Do you think she should be in it?
Probably, yeah.
How about telling a story?
I can do, like, skits at, like, Fireside, but that's pretty much it.
All right. You have great stories one-on-one. You're more of a conversationalist.
Yeah, I am. So my last question is, what is your favorite kind of story to tell?
I'll answer that question. I love an imaginative and adventurous story. One that, like, kind of pulls people out of the, taking everything so seriously and so, kind of black and white, and helps people see that there's sort of a joy and a playfulness in even the everyday kind of stuff, and helps people laugh at themselves, helps people, like, you know what I mean? See, just maybe see the adventure and the... There's that line in Hook at the very end when she says the adventures are over. Granny Wendy says the adventures are over, and Robin Williams' character says, no, to live. To live will be an awfully big adventure. And I like stories that help people see that.
So like, that is good.
Yeah, like the Peter Pan stories and the just the playful, interesting... Yeah, anyway. Mm-hmm.
I tend to tie myself right now to biblical stories, and so I don't know. To me, the story is that it's just got to be true, and all the stories in the Bible have, you know, warts and all, they're true, and so I would say the stories that have a little more, I mean, for kids, a little more adventure, a little more, like, you always want me to do Esther, that is a good story. But I don't know. I don't really have a favorite. It's more of a challenge for me to make a story, whatever it is, interesting.
Yeah, so your favorite is just storytelling.
Well, like, to me, the least successful story I told from the Bible is Ruth. I need to rework that one. I did not do well on that. But ultimately, it's about a woman who's sad, who comes back, meets a guy, gets married. I mean... There's not a lot there. I mean, there's more there, and that's where I think maybe the best stories are, where they have true characters, like the story of Joseph. I mean, that's an amazing. But he goes through.
Yeah. So you really.
But like, I just told the story of creation, and, you know, and that's multiple stories within a story. I don't know. I don't know what's the best.
Cool. I will say that I think camp skits. I really think camp skits are high art.
Yeah,
like they are.
They're
I
so
agree.
Pure. They're so pure and so, like, let's just play pretend.
Yeah. Right. And I agree. If they're done well, when you see a bad camp skit, you're like, oh, you missed the whole point, dude.
And usually it's because some guy counselor is like, I'm going to be the funniest person they've ever seen do this skit. And it's like, get over it.
Yeah, the best kinds are when you can just be silly.
Yeah.
And make it fun.
Mm-hmm.
No, I agree with you. There is nothing better than a good camp skit.
It's true.
Or just a good skit in general. I agree.
And I think, too, that kind of perception in life, if you live your life like that, if you just have fun, be silly, I think, don't take life so seriously.
Yeah.
It can help you out a lot. Do you have anything else you want to spill the beans about? You have 30 seconds.
It's interesting, the theology of play.
I want to do that. I still want to do that. I have so much to say about that.
I know you do.
I have so much to say about that.
I do think there's this theory out there, back to comm theory.
Oh, boy.
Kenneth Burke, he says I can't remember the name for it, but basically there's various views of life. There's a tragic view of life, or what he calls like a clown view of life, where you see everything in terms of not so much the tragedy, but you see the humor in all of it. And he has this, it has to do, anyway, it was very interesting. And I think that's with play. I think you begin, don't take yourself so seriously. You're part of a bigger whole. Don't worry, as a Christian, God's got this. Enjoy, play, see where it goes. You know, I think that's interesting.
I would even say, this is for the next episode. Yeah. So here's a teaser of the next episode we're going to do together, right? I would say that the universe begins with play. Because even if you read the creation story, right? Mm-hmm. God said, "Let us make humankind in our image," and there's almost a playful energy to that of like, guys, mm-hmm. I have this idea. Mm-hmm. Let's make this thing, like, right? Let's play pretend. Mm-hmm. Right? You know what I mean? There's this like, let's create a world, mm-hmm. and there's nothing more playful than to create something from your imagination, mm-hmm. which is exactly how the world begins. And so I think it's woven into the fabric of everything, but we take ourselves so dang seriously.
It's true.
And the other thing, apart with that play thing, is I wish I'd brought up when I preached it on Tuesday, mm-hmm. is when God made Eve, mm-hmm. you know, that first marriage. But what I missed and should have brought up was that, because not everybody's going to get married, right? Mm-hmm. It's also that idea is that Adam was not born to be by himself. There's a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
He needed somebody else. And I think, back to play, You need somebody to play with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can't, I mean, you can play by yourself, but...
It's just not as fun.
No, you need, and you need to learn to play well with others and how to play. And
I like it. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for talking to me and sharing a bit of your story, your life.
How long we go for?
We went for a while.
So is this like, how long is your average podcast? Spill, are you, spill
like
your
a,
beans.
It's like an hour.
Spill, spill your beans.
Because you could make this into two.
You could.
You could.
2.5 hours.
Okay, well, say goodbye.
Oh, bye.
Goodbye.
Thanks, guys.
Wasn't that a fun conversation to listen in on? And Ben and John are two of the coolest guys I know, and I really loved hanging out with them, picking their brains, and hearing more about their passions of storytelling. You can find Spill the Beans on iTunes, and while you're there, please take a moment to subscribe to this podcast and leave a review. Every review gives iTunes a heads up on what podcasts are cool or not, and I think this one is pretty cool. Last thing I ask of you is that you share Spill the Beans with friends in real life and on social media. And until next time, talk to you later.